have described the president's budget blueprint as a war on domestic production.
Senator Murkowski presses an Interior nominee about oil and gas drilling. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 12th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a top contender in this year's Iditarod race scratches after a bad crash.
He took a bad tumble leaving Roan in a place we call the Buffalo Tunnels there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Support for APRN coverage of Iditarod 2009 comes from Spenard Builders, supplying Devo paints, adding color and life to your home.
Former Willow representative Republican Beverly Masick pleaded guilty in U.S. District Judge Ralph Beislein's court today to one count of conspiracy to commit bribery. The crime dates back to 2003 when she agreed to withdraw an oil tax bill she'd filed in return for a cash payment of at least $2,000 from then VECO head Bill Allen. Richard Maurer is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. He was in the courtroom today. Maurer says Masick's crime took place before any of the other corruption cases in the state legislature.
The ones in the state legislature all were in 2006 and related to the petroleum production tax and also relate to a time when the FBI had a camera in the VECO suite in the Baranoff Hotel in Juneau. This one was different because it's a single incident. It takes place in 2003, and it's a time when Beverly Masick is in serious trouble financially, and so for some reason she knows to go to Bill Allen to try and resolve it.
And Richard, what happened in court today?
The situation in court today was an arraignment and a change of plea. She came in, heard the charges, and then she pled guilty according to the plea bargain she had with the government. It only lasted about 30 minutes. She was there with two attorneys from the public defender's office, and there were two prosecutors.
And how did she seem?
Her voice quavered a little bit, but it was hard to say if that was from stress or emotion or what. She didn't say anything except to answer the questions directly. Her voice was firm. She did not talk to reporters afterwards. She said she did not say a word.
Did she give any indication to the court as to why she decided to change her plea to guilty rather than fight the charge?
No, she did not. She was not required to, and she said nothing other than that she said she was guilty, Your Honor.
So what happens next?
The next thing for former Representative Masick is that she is going to be sentenced on May 28th. She had to turn in, she had an expired passport. They made her turn that in as well. She's free on unsecured $5,000 bond, which means she doesn't have to put up anything. And she's ordered to tell the probation office or pretrial office if she plans to leave the state. But the next thing related to this is her sentencing. She says she's unemployed.
Former Juneau Representative Bruce Weirach is still awaiting trial in the ongoing Alaska political corruption investigation. Climate change requires immediate action, and businesses like the insurance industry need to think about how a warming climate will affect them. That's the message the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation heard today. It took testimony from scientists and members of the clean coal industry and the insurance business about climate change and its implications. Alaska Senator Mark Begich sits on the committee and questioned one of the scientists about how melting permafrost will add to greenhouse gases. Dr. Tim Killeen from the National Science Foundation said it's an area that needs more research.
There are some unknowns there, and there's scientific research that's needed to fully understand the rate at which permafrost is becoming degraded and the reasons for that. Mm-hmm. And if you look back at ancient climate change, there's evidence that, in fact, temperature increases led the production of greenhouse gases.
Killeen warned that the more the climate warms and melts permafrost, the more it will release methane gases, which will in turn add to warming. Scientists at the University of Alaska Fairbanks are already researching that. Senator Begich also brought up concerns about ocean acidification.
You know, Alaska produces 62% of the natural fish stock for this country. And obviously we have about 25, 30,000 people employed directly or indirectly in this industry. Can you give me any thoughts of where research gaps might be in regards to studying the impacts of acidification, not only from the science, but also from the job component?
Begich said he wants to figure out how to interest the average voter in climate change. He said explaining the economic impacts may be one of the ways to do that. The committee's chair, John Rockefeller of West Virginia, warned that a third of the country's gross domestic product is sensitive to weather and climate. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar underwent a friendly confirmation process when he got his job earlier this year, but the man he wants to tap as his deputy secretary wasn't so lucky today in Washington. David Hayes heard complaints and criticisms from Republican members of the Senate's Energy and Natural Resources Committee, who are upset with the direction of the Obama administration. The committee's ranking Republican, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, voiced concerns about oil and gas production.
I have described the president's budget blueprint as a war on domestic production. Subsequent administration testimony has not altered my opinion on this.
Murkowski says while she hopes clean energy projects become increasingly viable, she says punishing the domestic oil and gas industry won't bring the age of renewable energy any faster.
The president's budget proposals would have this nation turn its back on workers in the petroleum industry, raise prices for American consumers, and increase the export of American dollars all in one fell swoop.
David Hayes served as Deputy Secretary for the Interior under President Clinton. Since then, he's been a senior fellow at World Wildlife Fund and worked as a lawyer and lobbyist. He's against oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and Senator Murkowski pressed him to consider directional drilling in ANWR. Murkowski also complained about changes the Interior Department is making to the Endangered Species Act, reversing President Bush's policies. She says environmentalists want to use the ESA to halt development all over the country. Hayes promised to discuss it with Secretary Salazar. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an emotional tribute to a top-notch basketball coach.
She kept teaching and she just stayed strong. What Lena Ferguson means to me is strength when I hear her name.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska. Study anywhere. Information at 1-888-4-ALASKA. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
The leaders of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race are on their way to the remote Iditarod checkpoint. Aaron Burmeister was the first to set out on the 90-mile trip this morning. He left the Ophir checkpoint at 6:17 with Hugh Neff, Lance Mackey, Sebastian Schnula, and Jeff King close behind. The GPS tracking system shows Mackey currently leading the race, fast approaching the halfway point of Iditarod. Norwegian musher Bjørnar Andersen has scratched from the race. He was a top contender in this year's Iditarod, having finished fourth as a rookie in 2005. Race marshal Mark Nordman says Andersen was injured in a sled crash between the Rhone and Nikolai checkpoints.
He took a bad tumble leaving Rhone in a place we call the Buffalo Tunnels there, and he bruised himself up pretty good, and he's concerned about some internal problems.
Nordman says Andersen flew back to Anchorage today to receive medical attention. He's the third musher to scratch this year, leaving 64 in the race. Meanwhile, the leaders are pushing ahead on the isolated stretch of trail leading to the Yukon River. Nordman says despite the deep snow, the trail should be in good shape.
You know, it's still snowing here. We're fighting with the weather with flying a little bit, but I think they're going to have a good trail. Local guys up in Shagluck, the Hamiltons, and others are now breaking the trail out, our traditional trail, over to Anvik. And then it's, of course, well traveled from Anvik to Grayling.
The especially snowy trail this year has mushers on high alert for moose. David Shurtleff has the story.
It might not jump out as an obvious consequence of the unusually high amounts of snow, but mushers say the moose could be out in full force on stretches of the trail.
It's a survival mode for the moose, all right? They don't have trail breakers out there putting trail in for them.
That's musher Eric Rogers from Eagle River.
If they're wallowing through deep snow, they're expending a tremendous amount of energy. The food quality this time of year is very poor. They're working very hard to get what they eat. So if they find a groomed trail, they want to get on the trail and stay on it because they expend less energy. It's survival. When we come up, they don't want to yield the trail.
Rogers isn't a wildlife biologist, but he does have a PhD in physics. And one equation he knows from experience is that moose plus dogs equals disaster.
I have been stomped 3 times before. I've been mushing since 92. The encounters where I was stomped were very fast. The moose comes in, runs through the team, kicks at a couple of dogs, and runs on. And I'm going, oh, dear, you know. And the heart's pounding, and it gets your adrenaline going pretty good. But that's all it's been so far.
And while Rogers and his dogs have never been hurt during an incident, it does happen, and once happened to Susan Butcher. So, lots of mushers, like Yukon Quest champion Sebastian Schnula, say they are taking extra precaution in the form of a weapon.
I am afraid of that, and this time, in a long time, I actually do pack a gun, which I haven't done in years, but deep snow brings that with it, so I want to be prepared for sure.
Fellow musher Aaron Burmeister says he'll be ready, too.
I carry a .44 Magnum with me, and I won't take a chance with a moose. If that moose is in my team or about to be in the team, it's going to be gutted on the side of the trail.
For APRN on the Iditarod Trail, I'm David Shurtleff.
High school basketball teams across Alaska faced off last weekend in hopes of advancing to the state tournament. The village of Chivac had the distinction of qualifying both their boys and girls teams. The accomplishment was the longtime dream of Coach Lena Ferguson. But Ferguson passed away just 3 days before the start of the regional tournament. Her players say she was with them all the way to the final buzzer. From Member Station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has the story.
Lena Ferguson was born May 8, 1953. She was born Lena Olron, and she came into this world on the tundra of southwest Alaska. Her family was moving from spring camp to fish camp. Her oldest son, Ulrich Olron, says his mother was a competitor through and through.
She taught my wife, Mary, how to make a blackberry agurok. And everybody would say, wow, she makes agurok just like Lena. Lena's agurok. And then my mom looked at me. My mom looked at me and said, but mine is better.
Olron is surrounded by family and players. They are now waiting for their mother's body to arrive in the Chupik Eskimo village of Chivac. Lena Ferguson was overtaken by lung cancer in an Anchorage hospital. She was never a smoker, but doctors told her family the cancer was inoperable. After chemotherapy failed to destroy it, she began to prepare her teams for her departure. Her sister and assistant coach, Mary Mutchin.
She taught me what to do and coached them the way she does when she's not here.
Lena coached the teams ever since they could score on a 10-foot hoop, but her players say she taught much more than basketball. Junior and starting forward, Margaret Anderson.
Ever since she's been told she had cancer, it taught me that you can't, no matter what hurts, it can't keep you from doing what you need to do. And she went to work and she kept teaching and she just stayed strong. It's what Lena Ferguson means to me is strength when I hear her name.
On the court, Ferguson developed one clumsy Chelsea Lake into their go-to ball handler.
When we first started playing ball, I was always falling down. All the time I would fall down on the floor and she would always yell at me to get up and start playing ball.
In Anchorage, Lena was surrounded by her family as she passed on. Her sons Connor and Cash Ferguson risked missing the regional tournament. But Connor, the junior, says he had to be there for her.
She was always there for you. And I really appreciated what she's done for me. And I made that clear the last few minutes I was with her.
Back in Chivac, the teams were gearing up for the tournament when they learned of Lena's passing. The oldest son, Ulrich, was coaching the boys' team. He knew he would need his younger brothers to play if they were to get past regional rival Scammon Bay, a team they had defeated by just 1 point on 2 occasions that season.
coming into the regional tournament, we thought it was going to be real tough for us.
In the championship game, as expected, it was the Chivat Comets versus the Scammon Bay Eagles. Ulrich says he was amazed as the game unfolded.
I think they were so pumped up to win this for Lena. Our boys played with such intensity that our boys got the lead and never looked back.
The Comets won decisively, 65-51. Lena's son, Cash, would lead the scoring effort with 17 points. The senior says the scene after the win was beyond words.
I was there half the time hugging my dad. Just emotions were running. The whole court was there.
It was the Lady Comets that would have a tougher road to toe. They also faced Scammon Bay in the final, a team they had dominated in earlier matchups. Now, with Lena's death heavy on their minds, girls were fouling out and missing open shots. Senior point guard Chelsea Lake.
I couldn't really play that well. I'm usually one of the top scorers, but I was one of the ones that scored the least.
The team played from behind for three quarters, but they kept praying to Lena for help, says forward Margaret Anderson.
We'd look at each other and say, for Lena. And we were all thinking of her, and it gave us strength.
Chelsea Lake was playing scrappy ball and had still not gotten over her tendency of falling down.
Sometimes I would even hear her. Like when I fall down, I'd hear, Chelsea, get up! And it would sound like her voice.
With just over a minute left in the game, the Lady Comets were down by 5 points. But forward, Missy Olson nailed a three-pointer, closing the lead and sending the home crowd into hysterics. The team rallied and ended the game in a 10-point scoring frenzy. The 50-45 win secured another championship for Chivac. Anderson describes the scene.
We were all so excited and happy, and the crowd came to us. We were all filled with tears. Even the crowd was, everybody was crying with happiness, tears of joy.
Now regional champs and state qualifiers, both Chivac teams will be matched up against Point Hope in the first round of the state 2A championship. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by the Alaska State Elks Wounded Veterans Project, raising public awareness to assist severely injured service members to help themselves and others. Information at alaskastateelks.org.
Canadian fisheries managers are gearing up for another critically low salmon run on the Yukon River. Despite unprecedented conservation measures, last year's run wound up well short of the target for fish reaching the spawning grounds. This year, contractors have been hired to play up the benefits of conservation efforts on the Alaska side of the border. The CBC's Brian Boyle reports.
To hear Frank Quinn tell it, last year should have been a fishing story about the ones that got away.
There was no commercial fishery, no domestic fishery, no sport fishery either. And we had voluntary reduction in the First Nations fishery as well.
As Yukon Area Manager for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Quinn says the goal was to allow 45,000 fish to reach the spawning grounds in the Yukon. They fell short of that mark by nearly 10,000 fish. Now, Quinn says contractors have been hired to speak to people who fish for salmon on the Alaska portion of the Yukon River.
For them, it's hard to watch the fish swim by their front door to come to Canada to spawn, but they've got to understand that if that doesn't happen, they won't be coming back in the future.
Quinn says early season projections are calling for another poor salmon run this year, and he's expecting fishing restrictions will be as tough or even tougher than they were last year. He says in recognition of that, officials in Alaska have agreed to delay the opening of any salmon fishing on the Yukon River until at least one quarter of the run has passed any given point on the river. Brian Boyle, Whitehorse.
The State Board of Game wrapped up meetings in Anchorage earlier this week. One decision by the board changed the rules governing the Nalchina caribou hunt, eliminating the scoring system called Tier 2 that used criteria such as income and how long you had hunted in the area. The new system allocates a portion of the available moose and caribou to 8 Otna villages. Other hunters can apply to hunt the remaining available game. The hunt has for years been in high demand because there is road access and it lies in between Cantwell and the Mat-Su area. Otna Corporation CEO Ken Johns says Tier 2 excluded some people who had always relied on the herd as a main food source, including the Otna traditional chief. He says ideally the state constitution would be changed to be in sync with the federal subsistence mandate of rural preference, but he says he hopes people will allow time to see if the new community harvest allocation rules work.
It allows for the villages to have an opportunity to get meat on the table, and it allows for other people to put in for a permit that doesn't block anybody out from hunting in this area, whereas under the Tier 2 system, it was limited to people who qualified.
But Alaska Outdoor Council Director Rod Arno says the federal rural preference mandate is unsustainable because it allows anyone that moves to rural Alaska, regardless of whether they have a history of subsistence practices, to have preference in times of shortage. Arno says the state has 23 subsistence hunts.
Two or three of them are controversial. And the others, you know, there's no problem at all because they are in remote rural areas. So the contention, you know, and the ill feelings among hunters are all in an area that, you know, it may be better to manage as a non-subsistence area.
Arno says the Outdoor Council has asked the game board to review whether the Nalchina Basin should still be a subsistence hunt game management area. Otna made their request for a community hunt for 8 villages with around 1,500 residents. The allocation will be for 100 moose and 300 caribou. Arno says that leaves out people that live in the basin and other communities such as Sourdough and Kenny Lake. He anticipates those folks will ask for their own allocation in a couple of years, which he thinks could present a problem.
So, you know, I don't see that this is the end of this. What will eventually happen is the board will be faced with each of these groups asking for a percentage then of the harvestable surplus. So then, you know, it will all be allocated out to little communities and large communities.
Otna head Ken Johns says Otna could only apply for the communities where they had authority, such as Copper Center, Mentasta, Cantwell, and Gulkana. Johns says the community harvest criteria fits in with their long tradition of hunting the basin's moose and caribou and their ethic of sharing, such as he will be doing with his son, who lives in Anchorage.
He requested some moose meat, so this isn't uncommon that I'm packing up some stuff from the freezer and bringing it in to them, so... You know, it not only feeds just individual, but we do a lot of sharing of our fish and moose and caribou.
The new rules for the Nalchina Basin will go into effect for the fall hunting season. Sitka hopes to reduce its CO2 emissions 25% by 2020. The Assembly passed a resolution Tuesday night to try to reach that goal. Sitka's CO2 emissions are about half what most U.S. cities emit and on par with Norway, according to information from the Climate Action Task Force. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
In 2003, Sitkins emitted 10.3 tons of CO2 per person, and in 2006, that number was 10.7 tons. Michelle Putz of the Climate Action Task Force thinks Sitka could be a leader among other cities committed to reducing CO2 emissions, because she says we already look pretty good, especially in Alaska.
And Sitka is looking like quite the green city when you look across the state. People are really looking at us as a model of doing the right thing and doing it well.
The Assembly signed on to the resolution supporting a 25% reduction of CO2 by 2020. Although that number is simply a goal, there's no penalty if it isn't met. Last June, the Assembly established the Climate Action Task Force, and its goal is to advise the Assembly on methods and means to mitigate the impacts of climate change. But city officials are not the only ones thinking ahead. Over at Blatchley Middle School in Stacy Golden's 8th grade science class, students recently designed their own businesses, which could be anywhere in the world, and they got points for using alternative or renewable energy and incentives for employees, like recycling and using public transportation.
I told the kids at the beginning, I'm not trying to turn you into hardcore conservationist. I'm not trying to get you to go out there and, you know, strap yourself to trees. I said, if you want to, go for it. But you got to remember that this is just a way that everybody's moving, and if everybody does a little bit, you know, we have to not be so dependent upon oil and just looking at other things that are out there.
This is our factory, and it's the number one producing factory in the U.S. of stuffed animals. It's in Arizona. We chose Arizona because it's like one of the best places to find our number one renewable resource, solar energy.
Some habits of our employees is if we're done at the end of the day, we have to turn off all the lights and computers and machines.
It's called Vaughn's Coffee Shop. It is powered by hydro and solar power.
That was James Young, John Dela Cruz, and Sabrina Gamble going over the finer points of their green businesses. Dave Papoy of Papoy Construction was one of the judges that listened to the presentations. He says green building can be expensive and challenging, but small steps that work toward renewable energy efficiency is the way of the future.
The population in the world is going to keep increasing, and basically the consumption of energy is going to keep increasing. So if you don't start making things more efficient here and there and taking little baby steps, you know, it's just going to make for life in general harder down the line.
Most of the businesses the students created were in places like Hawaii or Arizona, where solar power was plentiful or they could capture wind energy. Ironically, Sitka and its proximity to hydro energy didn't top the list for the students. Mayor Scott McAdams said it also doesn't really jump out on a legislative level. And he asked Michelle Putz of the Climate Action Task Force if that group could educate people about the use of hydro as a renewable resource.
At the national level, there seems to be a misunderstanding about alpine hydro as we deliver it here in our region. When people from the broader conservation environmental community nationwide think of hydroelectric, they think of the Hoover Dam or the Columbia River.
While Sitka does have a renewable resource with clean hydro energy, it's also functioning pretty much at maximum capacity for electric use. Putt says the Climate Action Plan will not only have suggestions for reductions, but ways to conserve energy usage in the future. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from David Shurtleff on the Iditarod Trail, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Brian Boyle in Whitehorse, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.